From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to this Thursday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony. Today and the rest of your week, well, a Wake Forest, North Carolina high school teacher required her students to reveal their sexual identities as part of a broader mandatory social justice curriculum last week. In just a minute, I'll talk with Tammy Fitzgerald, Executive Director for the North Carolina Values Coalition, about what she discovered when they investigated what they thought was just one classroom assignment, and it's not pretty. In my second segment, I'll feature some audio clips from the Marathon CNN Town Hall on Climate Change, featuring everyone's favorite Democratic presidential candidates, and give you some analysis. At the bottom of the hour, China's recent crackdown on Christianity has led to intensified enforcement of a law already on the books. Children and youth cannot convert to Christianity until they're 18. I'll talk to our friend Bob Fu, president of China Aid, and at 42 past the hour, I'll speak with author and cultural critic Mary Eberstadt about her revolutionary new book entitled Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. As a reminder, TonyPerkins.com is our podcast site. We will have resources, links, action steps, and guest information there, so be sure to visit. Follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins and me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, in Wake Forest, North Carolina, an English teacher named Melissa Wilson at Heritage High School had her students take what was called a diversity inventory that asked them to identify their sexual orientation, their gender, their religion, their socioeconomic class, and that of their family members and even their doctors. Unfortunately, my next guest learned that this wasn't just a singular assignment, but a symptom of something much bigger. Joining me now is Tammy Fitzgerald, the executive director of North Carolina Values Coalition. She's been tracking this issue closely right down her website, where she's documented the entirety of this mess, ncvalues.org. That's ncvalues.org. Tammy, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me on the show tonight. I really appreciate it.
Tammy, I got to tell you, I get all of your emails. I love what your organization does. It is so critically important to get out information like this. When this particular story crossed the transom and came to my email inbox, I almost had a heart attack. So this particular incident, let's just start with the tip of the iceberg. This diversity index was shocking in and of its own, but you all began to dig a little deeper. And what are you finding that's of greater concern in Wake Forest?
Well, the diversity inventory has been done before by this same teacher in the classroom. In fact, this teacher did it last February in her classroom, and a parent complained at that point, multiple parents complained, and the principal sent a letter to them in February saying that what was wrong with it, in his view, was that the teacher didn't wait until later in the semester. But very important, in this letter, the principal disclosed that this was being done. These types of lessons were being taught system-wide across the system. And so that's what made us begin to dig deeper. And we learned that about 4 or 5 years ago, the school system formed an internal office called the Office of Equity Affairs. Now, if you inserted the letters A and L in equity, it would be the word equality. So it's descriptive of what they're doing. This is a massive scheme by the school system to teach diversity, social justice, and in the standards that this Equity Affairs Office has put out as their standards for practice, They're called social justice standards. There are four anchors that teach 20 different standards. And the four anchors are identity, diversity, justice, and action. So in the last standard, they're teaching children to be activists, basically, how to act on their new belief system. But included within the curriculum that the Equity Affairs Office is putting out are lessons on not just sexual orientation, gender identity, but also social democracy, otherwise known as socialism. Thus, the questions in the diversity inventory that this teacher gave out on socioeconomic status. It's interesting that the diversity inventory has also been found to have been administered by other teachers in the Wake County Public School System. And even today, we've gotten emails and Facebook messages and phone calls from teachers in the system who are verifying that this has been taught system-wide, that it's being implemented system-wide by the school system, and that there is an intolerance within the system for teachers or administrators who would object on conscience rights. So it seems that this is even bigger than the Wake County public school system. We've gotten a message today from a teacher in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and apparently they're using parts of the curriculum there as well. We also learned that some of the curriculum they're using is from a group called Tolerance.org, which is a project of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Of course. Well, you know, the minute I read this story and I saw Tolerance.org, I went, gosh, that rings vaguely familiar with another left-wing, highly biased, extremely politicized shoehorn movement that the SPLC is kind enough to provide for free with benign-sounding terms like equality, equity, diversity, and justice, which all sound very kind and very nice, except when there is one particular, very large group of students, those that adhere to a conservative or a Christian or an Orthodox viewpoint on things like, for example, politics or sexuality, who are in fact being farmed out, who are being eliminated, for whom they are directing actual bias. So when we see terms like this, Tammy, you and I, who understand this issue very closely, social justice, it sounds very nice. It sounds very open-hearted and charitable. But these are attempts to shoehorn through a standard in a equality lesson entirely differential sets of beliefs that push a hard left agenda. And this teacher's response, I've read what you've laid out on your website. Again, I want to tell our friends to go to ncvalues.org, where there are actually images of these assignments. She made them stand up in front of the class and read through their diversity indexes. My jaw is on the floor. Aside from the politics, the invasion of privacy is stunning.
It is. And she also sent them to different parts of the room where she had posted posters around the top of the room for the identity that they identified with. So she made them physically move to the section of the room with the people with whom they identified sexually. Now, the teacher has also been known to do stick figures where she has the student write on the piece of paper an identity that describes them. The teacher presented a PowerPoint presentation that the parents in the room have been unable to obtain despite doing a public records request for the PowerPoint. And we've heard this from multiple parents across the system. But just briefly, what this assignment did, this diversity inventory specifically, is it violated federal and state laws on privacy, student privacy. We have a federal law that was enacted in 1974 called the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, otherwise known as FERPA, and it prohibits schools from conducting surveys on sex behaviors and attitudes, as well as other things. So there are several sections of the FERPA that this diversity inventory violated, but it also violated state law. We passed a state law just in 2014 that protects the privacy and identities of students. And so this teacher, even though she has violated federal and state law, and parents have asked for this consequence, the teacher has not been fired, placed on suspension, or reprimanded. They just asked the teacher to desist the inventory, and that is all the school system has done.
And in the sort of human resources meeting where these parents had an opportunity to complain, you know, they were really up in arms. But at the same time, these are parents who understandably are afraid of being called bigots or shut out further on their child's education. And I read, Tammy, that one parent's house was even vandalized.
Yes, yes, after the meeting yesterday morning. Now, as well, other parents in the group have been called out by other teachers in the school for their bigoted attitudes. And so this is a widespread endemic in the faculty at this particular school. And as we're hearing things come in today, it seems to be widespread in the whole Wake County system. It's shocking that when parents called and asked for a meeting with the principal of the school, they were given a meeting with a lawyer who represents the human rights, HR department.
Of course.
And so, yes, and so the lawyer basically represented to these parents that he was there to protect the teacher's privacy, which is a shocking revelation, you know, given the irony of the situation where the teacher invaded the privacy of the students, yet the HR department was there to protect the teacher's privacy. So that is why we felt compelled to put the teacher's name in the article that we wrote, because the school system has done nothing to rein in this teacher who has violated not just the privacy of these students, but the law as well.
So we've got about a minute left here. What's the next step in this procedure now that you've dug and you discovered this is part of a bigger problem and these social justice standards? What are these parents to do now?
Well, we have been working with these parents today to send letters to the school system under the student handbook that the school itself has. The school has violated their own policy, so they're filing complaints. Formal complaint with the school system, and we will help them discover and assist in getting them to file complaints with the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education.
Tammy Fitzgerald of NC Values Coalition. Go to ncvalues.org for the entire story, including pictures that were taken of this curricular format. You're listening to Washington Watch. We have so much more to talk about. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, CNN thought it worthy of 7 hours of commentary from Democratic presidential candidates. We'll have some incredible sound bites coming up next.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, if you heard the passion in my voice last segment, it's because this is an issue very near and dear to my heart as a mother of three in public education. Let me remind you all to ask questions and to never be satisfied that you are getting the full story. Micro affirmations and celebrating tolerance, how to support the LGBTQ community, and social justice with your 10-year-old. These are all some of the topics that you can read more on at ncvalues.org. I encourage you to check it out. Well, during CNN's Marathon Climate Crisis Town Hall in New York last night, the 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls revealed how they would attempt to address the so-called climate crisis. Now, apparently CNN believed that it was worthy of a five-hour time slot from 5 p.m. to midnight. And while they marketed it as unprecedented, as it turns out, the network was in last place in total viewership between Fox News and MSNBC all 7 hours. So let me begin with the senator from the state of Vermont, Bernie Sanders. He of Democratic socialist fame, and I use very large air quotes. He addressed his support for birth control and for killing babies overseas with American tax dollars as he would repeal the Mexico City policy as part and parcel of addressing climate change. So one left-wing ill serving the purpose of another. Let's listen to what Bernie Sanders had to say.
Martha Redioff is a teacher from New Milford, Connecticut.
Human population growth has more than doubled in the past 50 years. The planet cannot sustain this growth. I realize this is a poisonous topic for politicians, but it's crucial to face. Empowering women and educating everyone on the need to curb population growth seems a reasonable campaign to enact. Would you be courageous enough to discuss this issue and make it a key feature of a plan to address climate catastrophe?
Well, Martha, the answer is yes. The answer has everything to do with the fact that women in the United States of America, by the way, have a right to control their own bodies and make reproductive decisions. And the Mexico City Agreement, which denies American aid to those organizations around the world that allow women to have abortions or even get involved in birth control to me is totally absurd. So I think, especially in poor countries around the world, where women do not necessarily want to have large numbers of babies, and where they can have the opportunity through birth control to control the number of kids they have, something I very, very strongly support.
So the Mexico City policy, you'll remember, is a program that withholds health assistance funding from NGOs, non-governmental organizations that promote or perform abortions, and would instead give money to other NGOs that provide family planning services. It's a Reagan-era policy. It has been suspended by Democratic presidents and then reinstated by Republican ones. So for Bernie Sanders to take into context the fact that repealing the Mexico City policy, encouraging abortions in other countries where women don't, quote, want to have large numbers of babies, end quote, seems a rather roundabout way to address a climate crisis. Senator Kamala Harris of California wants to somehow, through government intervention, lower the amount of red meat consumption, which she claims will help the environment. Let's listen.
Certain countries have changed their dietary guidelines to reduce the consumption of red meat in light of the impact of the climate change. If elected, will you be supporting change in dietary guidelines? And then how do you plan on implementing the changes so that people effectively change their diets?
As a nation, we actually have to have a real priority at the highest level of government around what we eat and in terms of healthy eating, because we have a problem in America. The balance that we have to strike here, frankly, is about what government can and should do around creating incentives and then banning certain behaviors. I mean, just to be very honest with you, I love cheeseburgers from time to time, right? I mean, I just do. But there has to be also what we do in terms of creating incentives that we will eat in a healthy way, that we will encourage moderation, and that we will be educated about the effect of our eating habits on our environment.
So Kamala Harris, she's dedicating $10 trillion in public and private spending. The amount the federal government would spend was not actually released by her campaign. But it must be said that in addition to controlling what you eat, she has also introduced, with your friend and mine, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Climate Equity Act. They announced it earlier this summer that focuses on frontline communities, those have experienced, quote, systemic socioeconomic disparities. But it gets better. Mayor Pete Buttigieg made his own comments on climate change and likened it to perhaps the greatest battle and tragedy of all time. Listen.
We're only going to be able to tackle the climate issue when this amounts to a major national project that enlists the abilities of the public sector, the private sector, the academic sector, and folks who up until now have often been made to feel like they're part of the problem, like rural America. How are we actually going to get it done? Because we've been having this same conversation for years. I think in order for that to happen, we have to actually unify the country around this project. This is the hardest thing we will have done, certainly in my lifetime as a country. This is on par with winning World War II, perhaps even more challenging than that.
Okay, so let me just remind our listeners here that nearly 417,000 U.S. soldiers were killed during the course of World War II, a number that pales in comparison to other countries like the Soviet Union, which lost more than 10 million men by some estimates and does not even take into consideration the millions of Jewish lives lost. This is how the battle for the climate has been promoted and painted, sculpted by the Democratic presidential candidates this season. I'm all for stewardship. We are all for stewardship. Let's go about it in an intelligent way. This is Washington Watch. Coming up next, more religious hostility in China. We've got Bob Fu from China Aid coming up on Washington Watch.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday afternoon. China's recent crackdown on Christianity has led to intensified enforcement of a law already on the books. Children and youth cannot convert to the Christian faith until they're 18. Now, churches across China are canceling Sunday school classes for children in light of the new clampdown, according to Mission Network News. And joining me with his analysis is Bob Fu, the president of China Aid, who back in 1989 was one of the Chinese student protesters in Tiananmen Square. Bob, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Sarah, for having me again.
So if this law prohibiting a conversion to Christianity before the age of 18 was already on the books, why now is the communist government cracking down on enforcement? What's changed?
So this is really part of President Xi Jinping's new war against the children's religious education. And of course, since last year, after the newly passed regulation on religious fairs, the Chinese government already launched a major war against minority religious faith, especially Christianity. For the first time since the Cultural Revolution ended, you know, the thousands of churches, including the government-sanctioned churches, were even shut down. And hundreds of thousands of crosses were forcefully demolished or burned or destroyed. And this new wave of enforcement of this banning any children under 18 years old to have any religious education or materials or reading Bibles is just a part of a new effort, you know, to basically what President Xi sees as a political threat for his ideology to control what he called the successors of communism. He took these children as that. So since last year, we already documented, that millions of Chinese Christian children were forced to sign a Communist Party prepared form to renounce their faith. I mean,
oh,
this
wow.
has not happened in 40 years. And many children now are also encouraged to even report their parents' faith, and they were enticed with even a monetary award up to $10,000 if they report a so-called illegal religious kind of evangelist. So the house churches are subject for a further severe crackdown.
So are these enforcements coming through the Religious Affairs Bureau? Is that sort of the enforcement arm of the communist government as far as Christianity is concerned?
The Religious Affairs Bureau is only one kind of the about 50 plus government agencies are enshrined to enforce this regulation. And I think, because the Public Security Bureau, the court, the prosecutor, even the neighborhood committee can declare this one, house church in their neighborhood as illegal and even put a fine, financial fine, to the pastors and evangelists.
So, Bob, explain to me what has been left as an option for people who are professing Christians and who want to worship there in China. Is there an option to continue worshiping but without the youth, or has the government effectively driven Christianity underground in mainland China?
Pretty much you're back to the old Chairman Mao time. I mean, basically, said any, I mean, those who are allowed to exist in their Christian faith, I mean, some of the big provinces where Christianity is very populated, two-thirds of government-sanctioned churches were even shut down. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the Communist Party basically only allow a very small window dressing Christian churches where the pastors have to be have to demonstrate this absolute allegiance to the Communist Party ideology first, and on Sunday worship they have to sing the national anthem and dedication to the Communist Party leaders with the Xi Jinping's personal portrait hanging on the pulpit. This is kind of a Christianity they are allowed to exist. It's a totally kind of a Communist Party, they call it a sinicization. I mean, I call it a fascification. It's like a fascism in the 1930s in Nazi Germany. Anything that outside that will be totally banned and punished.
Bob Fu, president of China Aid, always so full of wisdom and insight on what is going on in China. We are praying for the next generation of Chinese believers, particularly now that we understand the ability to even reach them with the gospel has been further limited. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday. Coming up next, I'll talk to one of my favorite authors, essayist, novelist, playwright, scholar, Mary Eberstadt, about her new book entitled Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Coming up next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org /engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Thursday afternoon. Again, a reminder, our podcast website is TonyPerkins.com. We encourage you to visit for more information, links, and action items. Well, I'm particularly excited about my next guest because she is what I would consider to be one of the preeminent cultural critics of our day. She is an essayist, a playwright, a scholar, an author, senior fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute, and her most recent book is Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Mary Eberstadt, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
So I'm so excited because this is sort of the most recent in a body of work that you developed, starting with your first book, which is sitting on my bookcase shelf at home, and that was Home Alone America. And you've addressed this notion of what the various consequences were of the sexual revolution, and they are myriad. But this is really sort of your newest take on what is an ultimate outcome of something at the time that stemmed from what I'm sure is a very basic question, and I'm going to borrow from Luma Sims' most recent evaluation of your book at Public Discourse, when she referenced Pope John Paul II, the quest for meaning, which has always compelled the human heart. But I want to go first to the title, because Primal Screams jumps off you when you go to the Amazon page to look for your book. So where was this notion of primal screaming? Where did that title for you capture the imagination?
Well, as you kindly mentioned, I've been looking pretty systematically at the unanticipated fallout of the sexual revolution. And earlier books looked at what it was doing to children, what it was doing to romance, what it was doing to the churches. And in this book, which I see as the final capstone of that work, I'm looking at what is it doing at its widest to politics, to Western civilization, really. And the argument of the book is that all of the changes since the 1960s, all of those social revolutions, fatherlessness, massive abortion, broken homes, smaller families, et cetera, all of these have had the net effect of subtracting people from individual lives, subtracting family members. And the individuals, I think, have become so unmoored from familial identity that they are now looking frantically to political identities and other collective identities to find out who they are. And this is really without precedent in human history. No one else had this collective delusion that we don't know who we are. So why are we having it? That's what I'm trying to get at in the book.
And really, this is, as you've described, this is sort of the fundamental question that goes to the nature of what we all ask ourselves at some point or another, depending on where we are and our understanding of faith, our understanding of family. But who am I? What significance do I have? And here we are, sort of self-segmented, siloed into these categories by our characteristics, our beliefs, our sexual orientations, our gender expressions. But unfortunately, that leaves people like you and I, who are of conservative Orthodox thought, in sort of the outside group of these isms, right? So we are those who have a traditional perspective on things. We adhere to a biblical valuation of human worth, and that automatically means that we are in an unpreferred category. So how do individuals like you and I, how do we overcome this notion of identity politics if we are a disfavored identity ourselves?
Well, what I'm trying to do in the book is use reason and hold up a mirror to where we are now in the hopes that some people might change their worldview because of it. Because, look, Sarah, here's what I'd like to say. 2 points about what's been lost. How did people before us answer the question, who am I? I think there were two basic ways. One, by reference to your familial relations. Who am I? I'm a mother, I'm a cousin, I'm a sister, I'm a second cousin, et cetera, et cetera. But when you've had this trauma to the family unit on a massive scale, there are a lot of people who can't answer that question by reference to family. It's become too unstable. Families form and unform, couple and uncouple. So that answer is gone. And the other answer that is gone is the religious answer to that question. Who am I? I am a child of God. Right? Mm. That's the Christian understanding. That's my identity, not my sex, not my color, not these other incidental things about me. No, yes. I'm a child of God. And of course, given Western secularization, a lot of people don't have access to that answer either. So I think, in effect, many people now, after 6 decades of these social revolutions, are cast adrift. And they really don't know who they are, and they are frantically paddling for the nearest thing that looks like a raft they can hold on to. And that's why we're seeing this panic on campuses, I believe, the panic of identity politics, which I talk about in the book.
That's actually something that particularly interests me. In fact, we opened up the show today with a discussion about a diversity index that was being handed out to students at a public high school down in North Carolina. And I'm particularly compelled by the notion of why on college campuses, why now even in high school, as we're sort of moving down the ranks, that compels us so much. We are so attracted to the notion of who looks most like us or speaks most like us, and why we need to be safe in that sort of grappling, that desperate grappling for a sense of identity. So part of what I want to talk about, and you had a piece on this recently in Quillette that was exceptional, but it was this notion of the great scattering. Can you explain how that comes into play?
Yes, that's my attempt to capture in one phrase the various phenomena since the 1960s that have estranged us from the natural familial order of things. The great scattering. Families are more disconnected and atomized and also smaller than they ever were before. And so one of the things that I think is interesting here is to compare us to other social animals. And there is research in the book by behavioral, people who study animal behavioral science, because it's very relevant here, Sarah. We know that if elephants, for example, live in an atomized way, they develop terrible problems. This is one reason why there's been a movement to ban them from circuses. And we know this is true of many other mammals. They live in families, typically nuclear families, where they have each other's backs, and they develop disorders if they are taken out of that situation. What's the relevance of this? The very well-documented fact that psychiatric trouble has been rising among young Americans, especially, for decades now. Rates of depression and anxiety are at historic highs. So I use this analogy to the animal kingdom because we've become, some of us, it's become so hard to see this in ourselves that I think pointing to the animal kingdom might make some headway with the argument that would be dismissed if I were just talking about people.
Right. I would agree with that. I think that's an excellent literary approach. So we're smaller, we are atomized, we are fractured, we are sort of the diaspora now of what we used to be in terms of a traditional nuclear family. And all of this is, it's an exceptional analysis of the state of affairs. And so naturally, my next question is there anything to be done about where we find ourselves?
Well, I'm hopeful because I can think of many examples in human history where humanity just went off on the wrong track and gradually righted itself. I mean, one example would be in the years before the Victorian era, there was the epidemic of gin drinking in London and the so-called gin alleys where mothers would abandon their children. And this became a terrible public health problem, crime problem, and moral problem. Well, the Victorians came along and reformers cleaned all of that up, and now we don't talk about the gin epidemic in London. And other drug epidemics have also been like that. I think that there's a real chance, given the record of the harm that is being committed, including the psychological harm, that people will come to their senses and realize that we have been living for a long time, I mean, all of my lifetime, since the 1960s in this very unnatural way, in a way that we're not meant to live, and that people are being hurt because of it. So I think for Christians especially, one take home from the book is understanding that this is a very different kind of argument. I am not dismissing or making fun of identity politics. I'm trying to bore down to the ground and see what's really there, because I think what's there is a lot of heartbreak and pathos, but people don't understand where it's coming from. They're pointing to these isms, you know, like the patriarchy,
right.
You know, all these abstractions as the source of their misery, or the gender binary, say. But what they need to understand is that the problem is actually coming from closer to home.
What I really appreciate, and I was just talking to a colleague about this today, is not only the fact that you are asking questions that go to the root cause, not just identification of some sort of a trend in the development sort of this body of work, but really asking the hard questions that so much of today's political dialogue covers at a surface level, but never really goes deep on. And what I particularly appreciated was your empathy truly for these lost souls, and the fact that there was no derision when you were talking about those who identify as sort of a subset of a subset of a subset and need for themselves safe spaces or particular acronyms or whatever manifestation of the alphabet soup it is. You really talked about the fact that there are these primal screams are really an expression of agony. If there is no right relationship with Christ, if there is no relationship there, no understanding of inherent value because we are loved, because we are pursued, it really answers for me a multiplicity of other sort of conditions, including depression, including anxiety, opioid addiction, suicide, because it goes to such a fundamental question. So that tenderness for me is, I would say, one of the best parts of this book.
Well, you know, I think moral traditionalists get a bad rap, of course, and are in a minority. But to me, this kind of work is humanitarian work because it is responding to the fact that there's a lot of suffering out there. When you see kids on college campuses in these demonstrations against unpopular speakers, taping their mouths shut and marching around and, you know, chanting monosyllabically, you're not seeing happy people, first of all. You're seeing a kind of collective delusion. And you're also seeing people operating at a very infantile level, which is why I say in the book that identity politics is pre-politics. It's coming from a much more primordial place. And we want those people to be functioning citizens of society, among other things. So we need to understand the hurt out there, but also what's driving it. When you see demonstrations about not getting to wear certain costumes on Halloween because of cultural appropriation,
right,
what that makes me think of, Sarah, is the tantrum of a toddler. You know, this insistence that this thing is mine, it's mine, and you can't have it, and you can't touch it, and you can't take it away from me. When what people are talking about are, you know, ethnic sandwiches or certain kinds of dress-up,
right,
you can see how unhinged things have become, but you can also see why is it so important to, you know, adolescents and young adults in particular to be establishing what's theirs. Well, I think the reason is that they're not getting that answer from their family structure anymore. And I don't just mean that in the matter of individual families. We're social animals, you know, so if there's a lot of unrest and anxiety in our society, which I think there is, we're going to be picking up on the cues of that, whatever our particular situations are. So I think this kind of panic is also contagious, and that's part of what we're seeing in identity politics.
Mary, what's your next project in this minute we have left? Are you at work on another book?
Well, having just managed to get this one out, I haven't really thought that far. Thank you for asking, but I do see this as the last part of a puzzle that I've been trying to work out for over 10 years now. I hope it does some good. I hope it changes some minds and hearts.
Hmm. Mary Eberstadt, author, scholar, cultural critic, has been our guest today on Washington Watch. The book, again, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. You can find the book there, as well as the rest of her body of work on the sexual revolutions and its revolution and its many consequences, including Home Alone America, Adam and Eve After the Pill, and How the West Really Lost God. It is the capstone, and we encourage you to check it out. This has been Washington Watch. I've been your host today, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. We'll see you tomorrow on the Friday edition of Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.